coming up on this episode of The Unapologetic Show.
Why is that? Because we have an ontological grounding for God as the good being by whom his commands are issued.
Right.
And so when it comes to God's divine commands, it flows out of his good being.
Bobby, there is a really well-known YouTuber named Cosmic Skeptic. His first name is Alex O'Connor. And
his last name, right?
Well, his last name, he's growing in popularity. He's been on The Unbelievable Show. He's had, several high-profile debates. His channel is continuing to grow. And he's done a series on, the morality of God or objective morality. And you have a background in that. So tell us a little bit about your experience with Alex O'Connor, the Cosmic Skeptic. And then we'll maybe jump in. We'll watch some clips and have you respond. Onto that.
Sure. I'm not real familiar with Alex. I haven't paid a lot of attention to his work. But when I have seen him, he's incredibly likable. I like this young man. He's sharp. He's thoughtful. And so I think he's the kind of guy that you could sit down and have a cup of coffee with,
right,
and you'd really enjoy him. He's not like the four horsemen of the new atheism that come across belligerent and harsh. I think he has a respect for people and cares about people, and it comes through in the way that I see him communicate. And for that, my hat's off to him. I really appreciate him. Obviously, I wish he was a Christian, but at the same token, I sure appreciate any time you see somebody that isn't one that knows how to just still be diplomatic, and I think he gets an A for that.
Yeah, I would agree with all of what you said, and I've seen him on his channel do something that I think is fairly unique, particularly in the YouTube atheist realm, where he's actually gone back and he's critiqued some of his own videos after he's researched, after he's done a little bit more homework on the topic, and said, I was wrong here, and this is why. Not that he was wrong in his atheism or his conclusion, but just the argument that he presented, he said that wasn't really a fair representation of the argument. I thought that was really excellent. Yeah,
humility.
Yeah, and I just a great, kind of humble perspective that he has, and I really enjoy that. So that's why I thought it'd be great for us to respond to some of these videos that he has. Do you want to go ahead and dive in here?
Yeah, let's do it, Brad.
All right, so we're going to watch this first clip, and then we'll respond to it.
So I suppose I would define morality as the intuition that we ought to do that which is good and ought not to do that which is bad. This definition is incredibly broad, of course, but with good reason. The reason is that it can encompass all popular notions of morality, and so we don't need to fall at the first hurdle. For instance, Sam Harris's notion that we ought to do that which brings about well-being, and thinking that well-being is good, is a belief that we ought to do that which is good. It fits our definition. Religious morality, too, fits into it, since the religious feel we ought to do that which God has defined as good. This is why I think this is the best definition of morality to start with, because it's broad enough that we can all agree with it. But it's important to keep in mind that the definition is composed of two parts, the good and bad, and the ought and ought not. They're not the same thing, and we'll see why this is so important shortly.
Bobby, do you agree with his definition of morality there?
I think there's another piece that was a part of his definition, and it relates to the word intuition. Mm. So that morality is an intuition. Well, I'm comfortable recognizing that we have a conscience and that's an instrument and we need to reason in order to understand it. I think that morality is bigger than just a hunch or an intuition. Mm. We have reasoning capacity and we need to utilize that. Now we can reason about our intuition, but I think reason should be a part of the definition as well. Not only that, when it comes to ought, we end up with what we call the grounding issue.
Okay.
And I know that that is something that we would want to cover in this episode. Mm-hmm. So as it relates to morality being something that we ought to do or ought not to do, it begs the question, why ought we to do it and why ought we not to do it? It also begs the question, if we're going to utilize intuition, then how do we avoid subjectivism and moral relativism? Because one person's intuition will look different than another person's intuition. One person might feel he ought to do something that another person feels he ought not to do. And so this can create some moral perplexity. Now, he brought up Sam Harris. Sam Harris wrote a book called The Moral Landscape.
Yeah.
And Sam Harris is one of the new atheists, and he believes that you can have objective morality. Now, a lot of atheists aren't so bold. You will have more so than not, they would rather say that morality is subjective. It's relative. There is no absolute right or wrong.
Right.
And so one of the things that we end up with the moral landscape is for, Sam Harris, human flourishing, whatever produces human flourishing, that's kind of the objective good. But what one person defines as human flourishing, another person would say this breaks down the culture. Just take the LGBTQ plus.
Right.
We know that there are various people on both sides of the spectrum. Some would say we ought to be pro-LGBTQ. Mm. Others would say we ought not. Some would say my intuition says we should comply. Right. Others would say my intuition says we should resist. So I think there needs to be something bigger than just our intuition. And then I think that when it comes to what we ought to do and what we ought not to do, we have to have something bigger than what Sam Harris says as well, and that which is produces flourishing or well-being. We need to have a grounds for morality.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because our intuition can be so shaped by our culture, right? It can be so shaped by our surroundings and the things that we're taking in. And so the more that it happens, the more it kind of shifts that intuition a little bit. So I think that's an excellent point. Ought seems to imply that there is an end goal, that there is a telos, or that there is a purpose for that. Do you see that as well? Maybe you could talk a little bit about the is-ought fallacy of Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, well, I do think that Kant was troubled, obviously, by the ought. And for him, ought implies can. Mm. So if I ought to do something, it implies I can.
Okay.
But the way that Immanuel Kant reasoned is he realized that, we ought to be perfect, basically. Mm. But we can't do that. So what's that going to take? Well, it's going to require time and eternity
right.
for us to do that. And so he believed that we can do this, but we need more time to do this. Mm. We need more time to do what we ought to do.
Okay.
And so ought implies can. And I think that as it relates to this word ought, we use it all the time in conversations. Even the moral relativists, I think once you press them hard enough, you'll get them to see that there are certain things that we ought to do. I mean, they'll know that intuitively, but their reason might not surrender that claim.
Right.
Because they don't want to give up their moral relativism.
Yeah.
But when you don't give up that moral relativism, then you end up with people who feel that it's okay for them to do all kinds of things, which results in all sorts of moral absurdities.
Right, yeah. Okay, let's head to this next clip where he's going to be talking a little bit about this idea of, is all morality subjective?
What's the difference in a Christian's eyes between atheistic morality and Islamic morality? What makes one able to claim that their morality is objective, but the other not? Clearly, neither can actually be objectively true, according to the Christian, because they both contradict Christianity. So the only difference is that the Muslim believes their morality to be objective, even though it isn't, according to the Christian, whereas the atheist doesn't. And suddenly, we're once again in the realm of subjectivity. The only thing that seems to distinguish religious morality from atheistic morality, even according to the religious here, is that the religious believer feels like their morality is objective, whereas the atheist recognizes the subjectivity lying at the heart of ethical decision-making.
So here, he's really, talking about it's how we feel that really is that moral intuition piece that really sets it apart. So how would you respond to his claims here?
I don't think that as a Christian, we have to assume that all of the morals of an atheist or of a Muslim are subjective. Mm. I wouldn't accuse Muslims or atheists of having a comprehensive belief system as it relates to morals as subjective. I would say it's subjective insofar as it gets outside of what we believe to be the case is revealed in natural law. Mm. So our conscience is something that we share outside of just being Christians.
Right.
That is something that is God-given. I would say that morality is built in from birth. And so to get back to the word intuition, there is an epistemological intuitiveness that we have as human beings,
right,
that we can reason that it is intuitively wrong to take a pregnant woman who is about to deliver a child and cut her baby out and, you know, take the baby and slam it on a concrete.
Right.
Right. I mean, obviously, we're repulsed at the thought of that, yeah, and we should be. So I think that insofar as we have a shared set of values, then I think that we are operating objectively. Now, we might give different reasons for these beliefs that we hold,
okay,
but I would say that if an atheist believes it's wrong to lie, if an atheist believes that he should be faithful to his spouse, if an atheist believes that we should do good to others. Now, we might need to define what that good is.
Right.
I would say that I would concur. So I'm, you know, disagreeing with Alex's statement that a Christian is going to be bound to saying that all atheists and all Muslims are subjective in their moral claims. I think that there is a shared moral belief system that we can see pollinated cross-culturally, and that should encourage us.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I think one of the things that there's a built-in assumption here that I'd like to draw out, it's this. That in order to be able to say that that morality is objective, we have to know all objective moral facts. And so so what he's saying is, well, the Muslim doesn't have a complete view of all moral facts because the Christian says that they have a complete view of all moral facts and they're different. Same thing with the atheist. There's some incongruencies in those positions. So therefore there can't be this objective moral reality. And I think that's one thing that is really confusing in the way that he's kind of describing this is because if there is an objective morality, maybe there's only a few things that are wrong, that there is objective morality, but then there's, you know, kind of, there's some wiggle room here and there. How would you respond to something like that?
Well, I would disagree that as Christians, we have a understanding of all moral facts.
Okay.
We have an understanding, hopefully, and I don't think we do, but I think we attempt to have an understanding of all moral revealed facts.
Okay.
And
yeah,
so there are things that God tells us that are right, and there are things that God tells us that are wrong, and those things that are right we ought to do, and those things that are wrong we ought not to do.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that I have an acute understanding of all moral facts.
Right.
And so we can have epistemic humility, recognizing that we are bringing our worldview to bear, and we are striving to follow our conscience. We're striving to follow special revelation as Christians, and then we are seeking to figure out how this works out in applied ethics.
No, I think that's really good. So there's one more clip that I want to watch and respond to, and this is where he really starts to kind of land the plane, and I think it's going to be really important for us to respond to this. So let's go ahead and check out this last clip.
Let's forget everything I've just said about religious morality. Or let's say that you agree with what I've said, but you just don't think that your religious morality is based on a subjective recognition of the moral superiority of your religion, but rather on the objective evidence that your God exists. This, I'm sure, will be a common rebuttal. You believe that your religious morality is true, not because you've judged it to be ethically superior, but because you think that the God of your religion has been proven to exist, or your religion proven to be otherwise factually accurate. So, okay, I'll grant you it. Let's say that somehow we were to objectively demonstrate that a particular God, say the God of Christianity, exists. We know this for a fact. You might say that if this is the case, religious morality is objective, because if God is the author of everything, then it's he who determines what is good and what is bad, objectively. Clearly, if God exists and has objectively defined certain things as good and bad, we can objectively determine how we ought to behave. Morality is objective, right? Well, there's actually still a hidden assumption within this, and this is why earlier I was so stressing the importance of understanding morality in the two parts that I defined. Firstly, a recognition of good and bad, but also the idea that we ought to do what's good and not what's bad. So here's the single question that completely changed the way that I view religious morality. Why ought we do that which is good? I want you to really think about this because it's crucial. Why ought we do that which is good? Let's say that good really was defined by God. We've said that we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the God of Christianity really does exist and really did write, for instance, the Ten Commandments, let's say. We can therefore objectively say that murder, adultery, bearing false witness, etc. are bad, objectively. That's not enough. You still need to demonstrate objectively that because something is good, we ought to do it, and because something is bad, we ought not do it. Of course, it seems stupidly obvious and absolutely instinctive that we ought to do what's good. Of course, we ought to do what's good. But can you prove it? Just because it's instinctive doesn't mean it's true. Let's not forget the basic premise of skepticism, which is to take nothing for granted. The idea that we ought to do that which is good is a subjective impulse that cannot be demonstrated to be objectively true, even if good can be. And so even if God really did exist, and even if he really did define good and bad, there's still no way to objectively determine how we ought to behave. It's still reliant on subjectivity.
Well, he's living up to his name of the cosmic skeptic there with that little plug for the basis of skepticism. How would you respond to that? Why ought we do that which is good, going on his definition from the original clip?
Well, I feel like we could turn the same question around on Alex, mm-hmm. based on his definition that he described at the beginning of this program. Why ought we to do what is good, according to Alex O'Connor? I think we should ask that question. Yeah. And so I would think that the motivation that we serve an Anselmian God who's the greatest conceivable being,
right.
at least that would be my claim, that I think God is the greatest conceivable being.
Right.
And if God is the greatest conceivable being, then he would know what is the greatest conceivable good for us to do. He would know what is best for us to do. Therefore, he would know what we ought to do and what we ought not to do. So should we trust the greatest conceivable being or Alex O'Connor in his definition? And so we both got to come to the table and answer the question, why ought we to do that which is good? And for me, I could think of a number of reasons why I ought to do that which is good. Number one, because our Creator knows best.
Right.
If God made us, then I would think it's important for us to trust that he knows best.
Yeah.
Because God is good and we want to share in his goodness, because God has laid out a pathway that would allow for us to have the least amount of consequences.
Okay.
And we won't have to incur guilt. I think that that's one of the aspects that, and I've spent a lot of time studying, is the problem of guilt. We experience guilt, and that's something that we share across humanity, is this experience with guilt. Now, guilt can have an objective feature from the fact that guilt represents that I have morally trespassed mm-hmm. some moral law, mm-hmm. and our feelings are objective insofar as our feelings correspond to breaking an actual moral law. Mm. And so when I think about why I should be good and why I want to be good, for me, I'm motivated as a Christian to follow God because I believe he knows what's best, because it honors him, because I was created in his image. I best reflect his image in doing that which is good. That is ultimately what produces human flourishing. I'm all for human flourishing,
right.
But not defined by Sam Harris or Alex O'Connor,
right.
but rather I think that there's somebody out there that can define human flourishing much better for us. And I look at that as the greatest conceivable being, namely God himself.
Right. No, I think you're exactly right on all of those points. I think something else I would add to that would be, he's almost asking this question about why the subject should do that which is, you know, morally factual, that's the subjective moral realm, why we should try to do that. And I think that's kind of built in. Like, he's just saying, well, why ought you do that which is morally good, right? That's kind of his definition. And then he says, but you are the subject. And so any answer that you give for that, just like you did, any answer that you give will be subjective in its nature, because it's saying, well, I ought to do that which is good because that's what God has laid out for me. I'm trying to avoid guilt. I'm trying to, you know, whatever it is. And so I think there, again, there's this built-in hidden assumption that you really can't get around that. You ought to do which is good because you are you. You are the subject. And the answer that you give is going to be subjective in that sense. And so he's built the question around, well, morality is subjective because there's a subject involved, i.e., you.
Yeah.
Right? So how would you respond to something like that?
Well, I would hope that if there is a God, mm-hmm. that he gives to his subjects a conscience so that we can make faithful decisions that are in alignment with what we ought to do and to avoid what we ought not to do. David Baggett and Jerry Walls wrote a book called Good God. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate this book so much. In this book, what Baggett and Walls attempt to do is to say, let's concede that given, you know, this God, or excuse me, in their book, God and Cosmos.
Okay, yep.
I love Good God, but this was in their book, God and Cosmos. Mm-hmm. So what they contend is, let's just give the naturalists, you know, the fact that they could create a morality based on the cosmos alone. Mm-hmm. And that shouldn't surprise us, given the information-rich system that we live in and the beautiful cosmos, that we could infer some certain moral absolutes to live by.
Right.
And so they go on and they show people like Eric Wielenberg, who's also somebody who would ascribe to moral objectivity as a moral Platonist.
Right.
And I think that what it is it's generous. So like William Lane Craig, in his argument, in his deductive argument, he'll basically say, if God doesn't exist, then, you know, absolute moral values and duties do not exist. Right. You know, and I think that they go against starting off, you know, with a deductive argument. They utilize abductive argumentation, where they argue for the best explanation. And I actually like that because it starts the conversation off on the right foot, where you concede to the naturalist that they could frame up a moral theory like Alex O'Connor is doing, but then we want to advance the question beyond the cosmos. What better accounts for all the moral facts in our world?
Right.
Cosmos or God plus cosmos. And I think that when we add God into the equation, it's a fuller mosaic. The picture becomes more colorful and clear and helps us to understand. Why is that? Because we have an ontological grounding for God as the good being by whom his commands are issued.
Right.
And so when it comes to God's divine commands, it flows out of his good being. He is the locus of all moral goodness. He is the supremely good one. And so I think that on naturalism, they have a grounding issue.
Right.
I think that Sam Harris strives for objective morality, but it's poor in its ability to ground morality. Eric Wielenberg is much better at grounding morality in moral Platonism, in the Platonic realm. The problem is when you consider just moral abstract objects, they are indifferent. They are non-personal.
Right.
And so why should I be morally obligated? Why ought I obey some free-floating moral abstract object? So when you consider God then as, you know, a timeless, all-powerful, personal, good being who issues these commands, I think that we have a greater grounds for the moral decisions we make. And therefore, I think that the question that Alex asked us at the end can be much better answered with God plus cosmos than just cosmos alone.
Well, excellent, excellent response to his all three of these clips. Well done, Bobby. And you can tell that you have spent a lot of time thinking about this and a lot of time engaged in this argument. So I really appreciate your insight here.
You bet, buddy. It was a lot of fun.
It sure was. So thank you so much for checking checking out this episode of the Unapologetic Show. If you're listening to us on the radio and you want to watch it again, you can head on over to youtube.com/oneminuteapologist. And while you're there, subscribe, maybe like this video, and we will meet you next time on the Unapologetic Show.
Let's face it, evangelism can be a scary endeavor, especially in this culture. Do you ever feel handcuffed when it comes to sharing the gospel? Well, if so, let me introduce you to a crash course on evangelism that I have created for you in order to eliminate the fears so that you could do evangelism in a conversational way, in a way that's relatable, in a way that can resonate with 21st century America. In this 7-part course, you will also have the opportunity to be invited in to a Facebook group whereby you can meet other people who have some of the same obstacles to overcome that you might have, and you can connect with them and find a network there. I hope you'll join us in this 7-week journey to doing outreach, the Great Commission for Jesus Christ.
Enroll today at oneminuteapologist.com/courses. You've been listening to Unapologetic with Dr. Bobby Conway, the 1-Minute Apologist. I am your host, Tim Hall. Be sure to listen to Bobby on Pastor's Perspective Monday through Thursday, as well as like, share, and subscribe to the 1-Minute Apologist YouTube channel, where we have over 1,000 videos. We would also like to remind you that this is a listener-supported program. We would greatly appreciate your support in any amount so we could continue to provide this ministry. If you would like to be a part of our team in any capacity, please visit our website at oneminuteapologist.com. And while you're there, check out all of Bobby's books, courses, and even invite him to speak at your church or event. Thank you for listening to Unapologetic, where we defend truth without compromise. This program is sponsored by Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.